Thanks, everybody, for sticking around for the, I guess, last lecture for today. So we're doing a nice job of alternating between experiment and theory. So this will be another experiment talk.
Jason, you are not the last one. There is one more after you.
Oh, there's one more after me. So I will, sorry about that. I should look at the calendar. This will be an experimental focus talk and tell you about, so I was asked to speak about atom interferometry and atomic clocks. So we'll talk about how those two technologies can be used for a variety of fundamental physics tests, you know, in the tabletop and beyond. I'm coming from an experimental perspective that works on atom interferometry primarily, so that's sort of my perspective on this. But I'll try to make the case that these two technologies are very closely related. And so even though the language that I'll use is very much sort of from an atom interferometry perspective, I think of atomic clocks as examples of atom interferometers. So both of these technologies have a lot in common and can be used for these sorts of, looking for these sorts of interesting fundamental physics ideas that we've been talking about all day. I have the pleasure of giving two lectures today and tomorrow on this topic. So just a brief outline of what we'll cover today and tomorrow, depending on how things go. I might not get to everything here. I'll talk about sort of a overall motivation and introduction to the field, why it's worth me spending time and you listening to a discussion of atoms and light and why that could be interesting. And then today I was going to spend a good chunk of time sort of drilling into the details of how to think about the atom interferometer in particular, and atomic clocks, you know, is an example of that, and how they respond, how the phase shift that we use as a sort of our primary signal when we're making these measurements, how the physical questions of interest get encoded on that phase. And sort of basically what's the origin of our sign signal. And the idea here is to try to give a little bit of background on how we think about it, but to give you a sense of how these devices can be used in different contexts. If you kind of get some intuition for how they respond to different signals, you can start to see what they might be used for beyond this. Because I think this tool is broadly interesting in these areas, as you'll see. And just to make the point, there's a bunch of examples here. This is a selection that I just decided to talk about today. We'll see how many of these we get to, but just generic tests of gravity and other such things, which I'll say more about. And then tomorrow, I'll focus on mostly on gravitational wave detection and using atomic clocks and atom interferometers for that very exciting science goal. But I won't say any more about that today. Okay, so broadly speaking, we're talking about atomic clocks and atom interferometries, and this is just some cartoons of what those might look like. So we'll talk a lot more about this diagram here. This is sort of a Mach-Zehnder atom interferometer showing sort of an atom path falling, or an atom falling two different space-time paths and interfering over here. And this is a cartoon of an optical lattice clock where these little blue balls are the atoms, and this little trap that they're in, this is an optical lattice, so it's a standing wave of light, an interference pattern formed by intersecting laser beams, and you can trap atoms in that standing wave. And this is sort of how the best clocks in the world are now made. And speaking of which, if you think about by means of motivation for this, the best optical lattice clocks can now have a timing error of better than a part in 10 to the 18. So the fractional frequency error in that, so delta F over F of the atomic clock is now better than 10 to the minus 18. Which is just an absolutely mind-blowing precision. Converted into a time error, that corresponds to losing 1 second in the lifetime of the universe. So it's just incredibly good at measuring sort of a regular evolution of the atomic frequency. And so the question is, what is that good for? Why do we keep, and that's, by the way, no end in sight. I think that number is even slightly out of date depending on how you ask the question. There are now sort of differential clocks that are into the 19th digit and beyond. So there's, I think, and I think, you know, we'll continue to improve. So why do we keep pushing on that? Or another way to phrase that is, what can we use this incredible frequency resolution for? I'll try to make the case that these fundamental physics probes that I'll talk about, you know, is one answer to that question. And in particular, gravitational wave detection comes up as a great example for how to leverage that. So I've got sort of here an example of the strontium atom level diagram. Strontium is the one of the atoms that's used, as I mentioned, in the best clocks in the world. And the way these clocks work is basically identifying transitions. This is an example of one of these transitions, which are between two levels or up to an excited state that has a very long lifetime. So this transition, if you excite this two-level system between the strontium ground state and the triplet P0 state here, that excited state has a lifetime of 150 seconds for strontium 87. And that very long excited state lifetime essentially, it tells you this is a high Q oscillator. So it's, if you put this atom in a superposition of those two states, it'll evolve quantum mechanically, and the Q sort of is the number of oscillations that quantum mechanical state will go through before it decays due to spontaneous emission, and it has sort of many, many oscillations. It's an optical frequency ringing for 150 seconds, and so that's sort of what's under the hood for how these clocks have such high precision is that really high quality factor. And kind of bringing these two atom interferometer and clock ideas together, one of the things that some of us are interested in, this is my specific group's focus right now, is trying to use this same transition that's used in these best clocks in the world and to apply it to atom interferometry. So once again, there are sort of hybrid approaches that use the features of the clock and use them for what we would traditionally call an atom interferometer. I should maybe say one more thing, since I didn't already, if it isn't obvious. So a clock, an optical lattice clock or atomic clock, is all about measuring time or measuring a frequency of some atomic transition. So we're measuring time or frequency. In an atom interferometer, one of the big differences we're looking to measure typically inertial forces, so accelerations, rotations, and things like that, or forces. And so this is an example of an accelerometer. But the technologies are closely related. They sort of different goals there. So I won't say much about the following, but I just wanted to put this up to give you a flavor of this. So obviously this technology, we're using atoms, so we need some way to get these atoms and control them. And so the kind of main workhorse here for this is these cooling techniques that sort of have been developed over the past 30 or 40 years now to bring atoms down to, when necessary, all the way down to their quantum ground state. So you've got laser cooling. So this is an example of a magneto-optic trap where you have six laser beams directed in such a way as to make a cold ensemble of atoms in the center. And that's kind of the starting point of most of these types of experiments. And then sometimes you can go further than that and do evaporative cooling to make Bose-Einstein condensates. And so these ideas, as I said, I won't spend time going into it. In an experimental, in a lab that does clocks or atom interferometry, this is a big part of what you do on a daily basis, is getting the atoms to behave and getting the atoms down to the low enough temperature to do the physics in question. Often that is enabling for the sort of physics we want to do, but for the point of view of this talk, it'll just be sort of a technicality. Although if anyone has any questions about laser cooling or atom cooling, I'm happy to go into it. In particular, if you're interested, some of the more forward-looking experiments that we're planning require really, really cold temperatures on the order sort of below a nanokelvin. So there's a, I think, very interesting set of tools that are developed to do that. But that's all I'll say about sort of the source preparation for today. So finally, coming to also probably incomplete, but sort of more of a survey of the sorts of things I have in mind when I say fundamental physics measurements. So I mentioned a few of these already. Tesla quantum mechanics is another one that's on here. So what that means, I'll say more about. But very briefly, you know, quantum mechanics we've heard a lot about today. As an experimentalist, I might ask, how well do we know quantum mechanics works the way the textbooks say at new time and length scales? Maybe I don't even have a very good motivation for asking that question, but I can still do the experiment and see if things work the way I expect. So I'll say more about that. This is kind of the icon that goes along with that idea. This is experimental data showing a rubidium atom interferometer. And you see these sort of rainbow-colored spikes. This is the atom wave function being imaged there. And so that's an atom state where the wave function's been split by over half a meter. And you can ask, you know, that which is, as far as I know, for a massive particle, the biggest delocalized quantum state. So does quantum mechanics work? In this experiment, it looks like it does. And so you can keep pushing that and just keep asking, you know, how big can we make these superposition states? So I'll say a little bit more about that. We heard just about equivalence principle tests from Peter, that's definitely something that folks are interested in using this technology for in short distance gravity. I'll talk about searches for dark matter a little bit, and so forth. So this is an overview of some of the ideas. Yeah, sure. Yeah. No.
I deserve the microphone. This rubidium wave packet separated by 54 centimeters, I assume that you like launch them up and then you actually image them or something. You know, how do you know that it's one atom or whatever, you know, 10 to the 6th atoms that are split?
Yeah.
Versus just, you know, half of them are up here and half of them are down here. Yeah. Obviously, once you recombine them, you observe interference. But with this picture alone, is there a way to tell?
I don't think so. I would say what you just said is that I can't know when I've made this picture because this is a destructive measurement. So this is sort of a way to visualize what the state looked like, and then what this really is. You know, so you caught me being a bit loose here. This really is an image of the probability distribution.
Yeah.
And in particular, of an ensemble of atoms, each one had a 50% chance of landing in port one, or you know, in position one or position two, and we made a destructive measurement of that, and collected statistics of where you know that wave function was. But that does not tell you that it was in a superposition, I would say. So the way we can validate that is by not getting which way information, and don't make a measurement, bring them back together, and then see interference at a later time. Yeah.
And so how many were in the?
This is about a 10 to the 5 atoms. So yeah, so with a single picture, you're gathering statistics right away on that. But in you know, conceptually, you could do it one atom at a time. By the way, I want to encourage more interruptions. Actually, that's would be much more fun. So please, yeah, shout it out. Just that was a great example of how we can do it. Good. Worth going through quickly, sort of by way of introduction of the details of an atom interferometer. I like to use this analogy with light interferometry, which you're maybe more familiar with. And there's sort of an interesting role reversal that happens here in understanding how the atom works versus how the light interferometer works. So this is a light Mach-Zehnder interferometer, beam splitter, and belabor the point, but you need a couple mirrors to direct the light around after you've split into two paths. You've got a sort of lower path and upper path. The mirrors bring the light back together again, but it doesn't produce interference without this second beam splitter. Right? You can cross the two beams, but you wouldn't really normally think of that in an interferometer unless you sort of have this second beam splitter. And what that's doing is, if you like, it's dividing each of the incoming paths, and so you can see sort of two arrows coming out of each port, and those ports, those two contributions can sum constructively or destructively depending on the relative phase of the two paths. We can put some intensity detectors there, these green photodetectors, for example, and look at the intensity ratio, which would be a function of the phase shift. It's worth pointing out that you can also look spatially. So if you put rather than just a counter here, you can look at the interference pattern. This is some light fringes. You might see some circular fringes if you imaged that detection area, indicating sort of different paths as a function of angle, for example, through the interferometer. So you can see spatial fringes sometimes in these light interferometers. And so light reflecting off of matter beam splitters. But if I want to think about atom interferometry, I can essentially reverse the roles of everything in question. So rather than using light, we're going to use matter waves as the sort of interfering wave. So this is sort of an atom coming in here. We need some way to split the atom's wave function analogous to a beam splitter. and mirrors to redirect the paths back together to make the sort of Mach-Zehnder diamond-shaped geometry. And the way that that's implemented is with pulses of light. And I'll go into how that works in more detail on the next slide. But so it's kind of fun. Instead of using matter to split light, we're using light to split atoms. So you have a lower path and upper path. The mirror, as you can see in this picture, sort of is responsible for getting them to come back towards each other again. They ultimately cross at this point where you apply a second beam splitter, which is once again required to get the interference that you want between the two paths. And so in the case of a light interferometer, we were looking at the intensity of light in each of the two ports. In the case of an atom interferometer, what you're looking for is the probability of detecting an atom. You're looking at these two paths. You add the amplitude of the wave function along path one and path two together, and then if you want to calculate the probability of detecting an atom, you square that that sum, and you can get constructive and destructive interference of the matter wave, and that probability is what we are interested in measuring, and because it tells us about the relative phase between these two paths. And so to complete the analogy, you'll see pictures like this later on in the talk. We can also look spatially, rather than just measure the number of atoms, which would be, rather than just estimating the total probability of being in one port or the other, we can also look spatially. So this is also some experimental data showing if you look at one of these ports, in certain configurations, we can arrange to have a spatial interference pattern, where you see the blue regions are correlated, the red are correlated, and blue and red are anti-correlated. So this is sort of the probability of finding an atom as a function of position on this screen, and we can use that in the same way, it sort of has the same information content as these light fringes. I want to talk about how the atom optics work. So how we implement these beam splitters and mirrors using light for the matter wave. So it's very basic. There's sort of two ingredients. We need to be able to essentially exert some mechanical action on an atom. So the way that works is with light absorption and stimulated emission. So we have light coming in. For example, this is my cartoon of a two-level atom. So this is the ground state in blue, and then this upper state all indicate in red. So initially, this atom is sitting in its ground state. That's what this blue dot means. So light comes in. Light, of course, carries momentum. If this transition is arranged so that it conserves both energy and it will conserve momentum, the atom will absorb that photon and transition to the excited state, indicated by being in red. Of course, since it's absorbed the photon, it now has increased the total momentum of that atom. So the atom, while it was originally at rest, will now be moving with some velocity, which we call the recoil velocity, given by the momentum of the photon, h bar k, divided by m, the mass of the atom. So, and that recoil velocity for the sorts of alkali atoms that we tend to use is on the order of a centimeter per second. So fairly macroscopic velocity that you can get from a single photon absorption, since atoms are pretty light. Sort of the reverse process of that would be stimulated emission. So here, you start off with an atom that's already in the excited state. If we shine in light from the same direction, the atom will tend to emit a photon into that beam. And so now you get sort of two photons coming out, and it gives up its energy and its momentum, and it returns to the ground state. These two processes can be combined together and controlled very precisely using the phenomenon of Rabi oscillation. So we turn on a laser pulse of a certain duration, and while the laser pulse is on, the atom interacting with the light is undergoing these two processes coherently. So you start off, for example, if you're 100% in the blue the blue ground state, so this is sort of the probability of finding the atom in one of these two states. At time equals zero, you're, let's say, initially in the ground state. As a function of time, you see the population is oscillating sinusoidally between the ground and the excited state. And we call that Rabi oscillations. As I've written with this, the state here, there's sort of a correlation between the internal state of the atom, whether it's in state one or state two, the ground state or the excited state, and the momentum of the atom as it is absorbing the photon when it transitions to the excited state. And so that's where we get this mechanical action associated with the beam splitter that we want. We can actually split the wave function with that momentum transfer. To make a beam splitter or a mirror, all we have to do is basically wait the appropriate amount of time. So if you wait for a duration of where the area of the pulse is pi over 2, that puts you sort of at this halfway point here. And then your the probability of finding an atom in either the ground or the excited state is 50%. But in fact, it's better than that. It's a coherent superposition of those two states. So it acts like the beam splitter we want. And then if you want to do a mirror, then that would be corresponding to making a ground state atom go to the excited state or vice versa. Then you wait twice as long. We call that a pi pulse. And so you can see there, if I was initially in the ground state, I would end up in the excited state. So those are the kind of the two pulses that are most typically, those pulse areas are most typically used to build atom interferometers. You can combine those in various ways to make interesting interferometer geometries. Yes, please, question.
There must be some requirement that the time scale of the Rabi oscillations is very short compared to how far the two states are drifting apart in physical distance, right? Like if, let's say you didn't put it for a 2 pi pulse, but you put it for a 1,000 pi pulse or something. I'd imagine that the two states, the excited state, the ground state and the excited state, are actually drifting apart in physical distance, and eventually they just can't interfere in this way anymore. Is that true, or?
Yeah, well, so in some sense, so I would be a little bit careful because, so let me maybe point to this cartoon here. So I think you're worrying about, say, what if this pulse took a while, or like, you know, when I apply this pulse, where are the two paths in question? So, or maybe just as a thought experiment, I could apply a pulse at any time I want, right? And so what's going to happen in that case is even if these two parts of this wave function. So these lines are, of course, just sort of schematic, right? That wave function actually has some width to it. Let's say it's some wave packet, and this is just maybe the center of it. But still, we could pick a time where it's the two arms of the interferometer have separated by larger than the coherence length of that wave packet. So they really are totally separate, and you'd be able to image them in the way of that diagram that I showed, you know, the picture that I showed earlier. I could put a pulse and drive atomic transitions, and you know, I can just think about those two arms as independently interacting with the light, and I don't have to worry about how far apart they are. In other words, to address the first part of your question, that it'll still work. I'll be able to transition, and that's what's happening in the mirror pulse, right? That this, you know, excited state is going to the ground state, and the ground state is going to the excited state. In some sense, you could think about these happening independently, right? It's tempting to think of, you know, these as part of the same transition, which of course they are, but they could be separated by as long as you want, and it'll still work just as well. In terms of, I think the question you're really wondering is how close they have to be for interference to happen, and that's sort of why we have to bring them back together in the first place. We really need these two halves of the atom to overlap within this coherence link that I'm talking about. So that has to do with how big this wave packet is, and
how cold they are.
Right? And how cold, yeah, in fact, how cold they are is the critical parameter that sets the coherence link. The separation between them is given by that. So. But it doesn't have to be perfect. You can delay a little bit on either side of this, and you'll still see interference, but it'll start to wash out as you, in fact, you'll start to see spatial fringes on the interference pattern as a function of that delay. And when the delay gets too large, the fringe frequency gets higher and higher, and eventually you start not seeing interference anymore. So
I think. There has also been this talk of like large momentum transfer.
Yeah.
Like you can do multiple pulses to try to.
Yes, I will say something about that in a few minutes. Yeah.
Okay, so maybe I can wait for that. But part of my question is, like, is this what's limiting how large of a momentum you can convey, that you need to do it before they drift apart?
No, okay, that doesn't limit us. But what it does mean is the more momentum you transfer, you know, the further they separate apart. You have to make sure that you bring them back together, and so that you can. Ultimately see interference again. I don't know if this is helpful. This may not be helpful at all, but there is a very strong connection between, and even with the same language, between the sort of terminology I'm using here and what you often use to talk about, like, you know, NMR, sort of nuclear magnetic resonance type experiments, where you talk about pi over twos, pi pulses, and things like that. And so there's this idea of a spin echo sequence, right? And you can get like a so this doesn't help, maybe. Okay, well. This is a spin echo sequence, actually. It's analog, exactly the same, and it's done for the same reason, right? So where you know, in an NMR experiment, you do a pi over two pulse, and you start to get a dispersion in the there's a distribution of Larmor frequencies in a material, so you have different spins are rotating at different rates, and so you start to get decoherence due to that, and the pi pulse essentially lets them sort of recohere. It's called the spin echo, and then you can see sort of interference at a second pi over two. That's really what's happening here, but rather than in spin space, it's happening in position space. So the decoherence in this case is just the fact that the wave packets are separating, and this pi pulse acts to recohere the two halves of the wave function so that at sort of an equal time later, they overlap again, and that's the spin echo. So it's directly analogous to this language people use for nuclear spins in a sample. So, but that maybe only helped 1% of the room, so sorry. But good question.
Thank you.
So we can talk more about LMT, large momentum transfer, in a second. So maybe I'll come back to this. And so we talked about Rabi oscillations. I wanted to build an atom interferometer. So let's go through the details of this. So this is the same Mach sender I drew before. We've got sort of this diamond-shaped loop, and we're going to build it out of this three-pulse sequence. By the way, this is just one example of an atom interferometer I'm choosing to focus on, since it's a very common geometry. But there's other shapes than just this diamond that we can do. So we're starting off with the initial state of the atom. I'm just writing it as momentum eigenstate here and sort of suppressing the internal state. The internal state is labeled by the color again on here. So blue is the ground state, red is the excited state. And so we know those are correlated with the external momentum state, but I'm just suppressing that index. So the pi over two pulse, it gives us this 50-50 probability of being in ground and excited, as I showed you in the Rabi oscillation plot. But once again, that is a coherent superposition. So I write this as I'm still in the initial state P plus some state P plus H bar K. With 1/√2 out in front. And so then, I'm going to put a phase factor in there, e to the I delta phi, which is going to be the science signal ultimately we're interested in measuring. And this is schematic, so that phase shift, it doesn't just come from this initial pulse, although when you do the first pi over two pulse, you do get a phase shift due to that laser interaction. But this delta phi should be thought of in this diagram as really arising from this entire interferometer. We'll talk more about how that phase shift works in the next 10 or 15 minutes. So that's the first pi over two pulse. Then we wait some time t, that the atom drifts for a while, and eventually we want to apply this mirror pulse. And so the mirror takes the state p and promotes it to p plus h bar k, and p plus h bar k goes down to p again. So that's sort of happening at this midpoint here. The point there is we had some relative velocity between these two arms of one recoil velocity during the first half of the interferometer, and now we reverse the relative velocity at that pi pulse, and so we'll get them to come back together again. So after an equal drift time, then we apply the final beam splitter pulse, and this is doing the sort of resulting in the interference we want. So each of these two arms gets split by this pi over two pulse. So you can see that, for example, this p plus h bar k state. It's going to result in some amplitude here, in the case of this one here, in state P, and some in state P plus H bar K, that's this one, and then vice versa, this guy here can produce amplitude in each of those two final output velocity states as well. And so since you're summing those amplitudes, you get that's the interference effect we're looking for. And as you can see, whether or not these two contributions sum or not depends on the value of delta phi, what the phase shift is in the interferometer. So that's the wave function at the end of the interferometer, right at this point here, at the final beam splitter pulse. What we actually do then to detect is we let them drift for a little while. And take advantage of the fact that these two, these are what we call our output ports. This is port one, and this is port two. Our two output ports are nicely tagged, right? They're tagged in the fact that they have different velocity. So one is going to travel straight, one is going to go off of this diagonal. So this in this diagram, I'm plotting the position of the atom versus time. And so the two halves of the two ports are separated as a function of time. So I can just wait until they get far enough apart where I can see them individually. They're also tagged in spin, so they're two different internal states, and sometimes I can take advantage of that. So that will allow me to selectively count how many are in each of those two states. So that's the final thing we want to do, is measure the probability of being in port one or port two, so magnitude squared of these two components. And so you get cosine squared of delta phi over two for that, for example, for the ground state. And so typically to image this, you just want to count the population, and one way to do it is to take a picture. So this is some example of what that data might look like. This is sort of showing, you can see sort of two blobs which represent the two ports. This picture would be taken like right here, let's say. And so what's scanning here in this animation is the phase delta phi. And depending on what that phase is, you either see all the atoms in one place or the other, or some combination. And so we take a picture, we look, I should it's worth clarifying now, if I had one atom, and this was one atom that we've been sort of implicitly talking about, this would be the probability of finding that one atom in one port or the other. But in fact, typically we use an ensemble of atoms, like say 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 atoms, and then on a single measurement, you're going to get that distribution that's shown here. You'll be able to count the ratio of the two states and infer the phase from that. So that's how the interferometer geometry tends to go. There's a few different ways to. Oh, please, yeah, another question.
In the first, one of the very first slides you showed, you did like the cartoon of the laser, the cartoon of the atom, and then the atom you showed interference fringes.
Yeah.
But these are not fringes. So is there a different kind of measurement you do where we would image it as fringes instead of?
Yeah. So exactly. So to get the fringes, what you would want to do is slightly misalign the interferometer in some way, right? So there's sort of two ways you can do that. And one, the simplest way is to just tilt the laser direction slightly, so you're transferring momentum along, let's say, the z-axis for each of these pulses, and that's the h bar k we've been talking about. If on the third pulse, for example, you rotate your laser by a small angle, then sort of the transverse component of that laser wave vector gets imprinted onto the wave function, the projection of that onto the horizontal direction, and you'll see that. That's one way to get a fringe pattern, just by slightly misaligning the momentum transfer, so it doesn't exist.
And then not waiting until the two output ports have separated.
You would still want to wait, because what you would actually end up getting is sort of two conjugate patterns that are exactly overlapped, and so when they separate, you'll get sort of two patterns that kind of are 180 degrees out of phase. Because basically, if you look back at this diagram from before, I'm showing you what it looks like here. But there's always two ports of any interference like this. And so there's actually a second port that I just didn't show, which looks exactly like this one, but red and blue swapped. And the way to think about that is, since I tilted the laser, what you've basically done, we call this phase shear readout, because tilting the laser puts a linear phase gradient across the output port of the interferometer, just based on that kx component of the wave vector. And so you can think about it as a bunch of interferometers running in parallel. So let's say that this interferometer, this is time and this is space. So it's in space is in the z direction, but there's also the x direction, right? And so I basically made a bunch of interferometers at different x locations with slightly different phases, and you're just seeing them all lined up in an array right there. But each one has an upper and a lower port. And so conservation of probability tells me that there always has to sum to the probability has to sum to one along any slice of those two things. So why bother? Well, the nice thing is, with this single shot, we're able to see a number of things that you can't see on this in this animation, right? So if I want to measure the phase of this, and I just take a single picture, and let's say it's like right here, I don't necessarily know exactly where I am on the fringe unless I sort of scan that phase and see what the minimum maxima is. Because here it's showing I'm going all the way to zero or all the way to 100%, but you might not have 100% contrast, and so you won't know if your population difference is due to imperfect contrast or to a phase shift unless you actually scan between 0 and 2 pi. And the nice thing about the phase shear technique is you see that all in one shot. You see the contrast and the phase in a single shot. So we tend to like that, although they both have their uses. Good.
Thank you.
Yeah. Was there another question? Okay, good. Well, not good. Please ask more questions if you have them. I'll say a few things about this, because I'll come back to this, especially tomorrow. The idea that we have different ways of implementing these beam splitters and mirrors. So I've been sort of implicitly talking about atom optics using single photon transitions. It's sort of the conceptually easiest thing to do. Start in the ground state, and it looks like I've switched the colors here. My apologies. So now red is the ground state, but single photon absorption and stimulated emission. And so historically though this is not the most common way to do atom interferometry. However, it is what you can do with these sorts of clock atoms that I was advertising at the beginning. And so it's very exciting sort of new direction that the field has been going in, is exploring interferometry with single photon transitions. And the limitation has been you need an excited state that is not going to decay due to spontaneous emission. And so these transitions like the one indicated that have, I mentioned, 150-second excited state lifetime, that's a long enough excited state lifetime that I can build the superposition state and not have it decay on me during the duration of my experiment, which might be hundreds of milliseconds or seconds long. I want to make sure that lifetime of the excited state exceeds that. And so you need some pretty special states that live long enough to do that. Most atomic states, of course, decay on the nanosecond time scale. And so a single photon transition, if you're using an optical transition like that, it would drastically limit your total interferometer duration to like nanoseconds. So unless you have fancy states, single photon's kind of hard. So what typically has been done in the past has been two photon transitions. Like a prototypical example would be a Raman transition, where instead of landing in the excited state, which is shown here in black, where you would decay in like some nanoseconds, you operate detuned, so that's this dashed line here. You bring the laser off resonance, so you won't make a real transition to the excited state. Rather, you could talk about making a virtual transition to this upper level. And then if you use a counterpropagating set of beams, you can bring the atom from the from this state one here to this slightly higher state two. And these two states, in alkali atoms, for example, there's a pair of levels separated by a small energy difference that are both stable. And so you can do this sort of two-photon process, and you can see the cartoon of that here. You have sort of two lasers, K1 and K2, pointing from opposite directions. And sort of the story is you sort of absorb the K1 photon, and then you emit a stimulated emission into the K2 direction. So you essentially redistribute light into the K2 beam. And the net effect of that is 2 h bar k of momentum transfer, because you absorb this K1 from this way, and then you get another kick as you toss the other photon in the K2 direction. So this gives 2 h bar k, since K1 and K2 are more or less equal and opposite in terms of their magnitude. So that's sort of, and this has been the workhorse of atom interferometries with Raman transitions in alkali atoms like rubidium and cesium and things like that. You can also do Bragg transitions, which is just sort of a variation on the two-photon idea. So rather than ending up in a slightly different atomic state, this blue state, you can end up in the same internal state that you started with. And I'm showing here a small splitting between the fact that you're winding up in not no longer the initial state, 1, P, but 1, P plus 2 h bar k. So you can essentially scatter two photons and end up back in that initial ground state. And so the nice thing about Bragg transitions is that you can keep doing it. Once you've gone from 0 to 2, you can go from 2 to 4 and 4 to 6. And so there's this ladder of Bragg transitions that you can use to accomplish, to transfer more momentum, basically. So there's a couple different interferometer geometries I mentioned. This is just a selection. I'll go through this quickly just to point out that it's not just this Mach-Zehnder that I keep showing. The Mach-Zehnder is great because it's an accelerometer. And so that's commonly used for force tests or looking for equivalence principle tests, for example, this sort of space-time version of this, so with a sort of a one-dimensional accelerometer versus time. By the way, so you know the picture of that is you have an atom and then you split it and then you bring it back together. It's all happening along one axis. You can also make space versions of this where you actually split an atom and you open up an actual some area, some area in meters squared between the two arms of the interferometer. So rather than space-time, space-area, or space-space, and that gives you that gives you a measurement of rotation, it turns out, so you can make a gyroscope that way. So the Mach-Zehnder geometry is very popular. There are also these other geometries, this is the so-called Ramsey-Bordet interferometer, where you make this sort of trapezoid-shaped interferometer. And this is used, for example, in tests to measure the fine structure constant. Their experiments have set sort of competitive limits on measuring alpha by looking at essentially the energy that this arm has with respect to the lower arm. You've got higher kinetic energy on average in the upper arm compared to the lower arm, and so you're able to measure that energy interferometrically with the Ramsey-Bordet interferometer, and that turns out to be possible to help you measure the fine structure constant, which I won't spend much time on today. Just mainly want to emphasize that there's different ways to put these beam splitters and mirrors together to get different shapes. So for the next sort of 10 minutes or so, I wanted to talk about how we calculate the phase shifts to give some intuition for this. And so I think this is, I have more detail here than I think I want to go into, just given the time and I do have the details here, so I'll sort of leaf through these. Although if anyone has any questions, please feel free to stop. And so basically we're interested in doing this quantum mechanics problem of calculating, you know, how does the phase of the interferometer evolve while the atom is following these two paths. And there's a variety of different formalisms for this that I've sort of summarized here. I'm going to tell you about this approach that we tend to use at Stanford, which is to break up the phase shift into sort of three sort of conceptually tractable pieces, so you can get some intuition for perhaps which we call propagation, separation, and laser phase. And so but in the end, I'm just talking about a way to solve the Schrodinger equation. You can just simulate this or just solve it any way you like to get the phase shift. But it can be helpful to, once again, get some intuition for how, in particular, how clocks and inertial sensors, how they differ by kind of identifying at least these terms. So I will spend a few minutes going through these each of these three components of the phase shift and how they sum to the total phase that is, once again, our science signal. So first, propagation phase. This is the one that I think is the most intuitive. Essentially, you can think of it as the phase you'd expect if you were thinking about path integrals, right? What's the phase along each path in a path integral-like formulation? One way to talk about that is to define a Galilean transformation operator. So this is basically a boost and a translation stuck together. So here, XC and PC are trajectories as a function of time that denote where the atom trajectory is as a function of time. That's XC, and then PC is its momentum. And so I can define this Galilean boost, which will translate a quantum state to a particular position at a particular velocity. And once again, those are functions of time. And what this Galilean boost operator does is essentially let me trace out these arms that I've been drawing for the two halves of the atom. And so far, I've just been drawing these diamond-shaped free space interferometers. But of course, in reality, we've got we put all sorts of things into the Lagrangian or the Hamiltonian that our atom is evolving under, the gravitational attraction of the Earth, higher order derivatives of that, the gradient of gravity, the Coriolis force, etc. Anything you want, you can define that will set the classical trajectory XC and PC that the center of mass of the wave function is following. So so we basically just sandwich that Galilean boost into sort of the initial state, which I'm calling here phi cm for the center of mass. That's sort of the freely falling frame state, which maybe is like a Gaussian wave packet, for example. It could be. And then, in position space, what that looks like, you sort of have the internal dynamics. This is the internal energy levels, the ground state, and the excited state levels. There's sort of a wave packet, which we'll say is like a Gaussian. And you can see this wave packet is located at the classical position. So this just tells you that this blob is falling along the free fall path that the atom interferometer path that these diagrams denote. There's also sort of a carrier that wave pack is modulating. So this is like a plane wave associated with the, in PC here would be what we would call the de Broglie wavelength of that atom. So this looks like a plane wave, once again, on the free fall path with momentum as a function of time. And then the critical part from our perspective is that there's going to be a phase shift out in front, which is the integral of the Lagrangian, the classical Lagrangian, along that path. So that's just the classical action along the path. So basically, we just you can use this to glue together the different segments of the path and figure out each of these action integrals, and the propagation phase is just the sum of, over all of these paths on the upper arm minus the lower arm. And in particular, it's the action, but also the internal energy level itself, E, also comes in, and that's where we can understand sort of how atomic clocks work, since if we spend some time in the different internal states, we can get a phase shift that way too. So that's sort of, I think, the most intuitive contribution to the phase. There's this sort of messy correction that we have to worry about sometimes, which is sometimes the interferometer doesn't exactly come back and close perfectly. And we kind of talked a little bit about this. There are some questions about this very question about overlap in the two halves of the interferometer. So in particular, if there are tidal forces during this interferometer that cause these two paths to see different net acceleration, they can wind up not exactly crossing at a symmetric time later. And so you can see a sort of a zoom in of that here, where you've got X upper and X lower. This is like the lower arm coming in and the upper arm coming in. I've kind of shown the envelope, that's the wave packet, and there's sort of the carrier that I described on the previous slide that's being modulated by that, and you can see they're slightly different velocities because the blue one's coming in faster, so it has a higher debray the wavelength, and they're coming in, and you want them to interfere at this final beam splitter, but they might not exactly overlap. So we call that an open interferometer. And so when that happens, you get another contribution to the phase, which is basically this offset between the two. We call the separation phase, so the difference in the center of those two trajectories times this times basically their debray the wavelength. So that's the separation phase. And then finally, and this one's important, the so-called laser phase, which is the phase shift that's that results from the atom-light interaction. So we've got some phase shifts due to the free propagation. That's sort of your path integral phase. But there's also, whenever we pulse the light on to implement the beam splitters in the mirrors, we actually shift the phase of the atom. And you can think about that. This is sort of getting too much in the weeds, probably, but this is sort of, you're just solving the Schrodinger equation for the atom-light interaction. It's Rabi oscillations again, but it turns out when you think carefully about the evolution of the two states here, this is sort of the differential equation for those, it's a phase-dependent thing where phi sub L is the phase of the light, kx minus omega t. So it's the phase of the light at the position of the atom at the time of the pulse. And so you can sort of abstract away and get these set of rules for when an atom absorbs a photon, you gain phi sub L, phi laser, and when it emits a photon due to stimulated emission, you sort of get the conjugate of that phase. And so what this is basically doing is essentially encoding kx, you know, where that atom is when the pulse is absorbed or emitted. And so we like to think about this as sort of acting like a ruler, a wavelength scale ruler, since k 2 pi over lambda the wavelength of the light. So we're basically measuring where the atom is with that sort of micron scale ruler with each of these transitions. So those three pieces come together and form the phase shift, and I sort of summarize them here. I want to say a little bit about something that might have bothered some of you, which is that everything I've been talking about has been non-relativistic, and this is something that bothered us years ago. And so we thought through sort of what would you have to do this calculation a little bit more rigorously in the context of general relativity. And this is motivated by some of these tests of gravity that we were thinking about in those days. It turns out to be essential for understanding, maybe not surprisingly, how to talk about an atom interferometer reacting to a gravitational wave. So we'll take advantage of this formalism next time. But the big difference when you think about sort of a covariant version of that sort of classical calculation that I just outlined is that we're going to do a couple things. First of all, we're going to make sure that for these trajectories, rather than doing Newtonian trajectories, we should use the geodesics of the atom in whatever metric we're thinking about in a GR context. So maybe it's a gravitational wave metric, or maybe the Schwarzschild metric. But also critically, light travels at a finite speed. So you can see the photon paths that I've drawn here at the three times for the pi over 2 pi and pi over 2 pulses. Those are slanted at some finite velocity. That ends up being a subtle but very important correction to the classical calculation. I think I will say more about this next time, given how time is looking. But I wanted to point out this, this will definitely come up when I tell you about gravitational waves next time, is that simply resolving the sort of finite speed of light in these calculations makes you realize that there's actually a conceptual difference between the kind of atom optic you implement, which is sort of it should be a dirt effect. It doesn't matter like whether you're using a Raman transition or whether you're using a single photon transition. It seems like just an experimental detail, and yet it actually has a substantial qualitative difference in how the interferometer works, as I'm trying to indicate with these two space-time diagrams. So I've got in this case time is running vertically on these diagrams, and you've got sort of a single photon atom interferometer. We've got pulses. You can imagine a laser sort of is situated on the far left, sending photons out this way. We've got the three pulse Mach center sequence. If I want to do, however, so that's it. That will let me calculate the phase shift in the way that I just outlined for that interferometer. But if I were to use two photon transitions rather than single photon transitions, I need to have counterpropagating beams of light intersect at each of these ABCDE interaction nodes. And the only way to do that, as this diagram on the right shows, is I've got to have a laser on both sides sending light, counterpropagating. And I've got to have the photons being emitted from, let's say, the laser number two here, at the correct times that you have sort of this three-point intersection at point A, for example, where the two photons both intersect the atom, and allow me to do like a two-photon Raman transition. And that the fact that these photons have to sort of come at very specific times in order to make that two-photon transition happen turns out to make a big difference in how these two interferometers are sensitive to the technical noise of the laser, and in particular in gravitational wave detection, you want to do this, you don't want to do this, basically. So I'll come back to that point next time. So I won't go more into it there, but it turns out to be a really important conceptual difference between these. So it's kind of summarizing then these two different approaches, non-relativistic and relativistic. It's basically the same idea. We have propagation, laser, and separation phase. And essentially, the laser phase looks the same. Propagation and separation have covariant formulations. Basically, you're replacing this action integral with a proper time integral in the case of GR. I think we've got pretty good time still. The next thing I wanted to get to, now that we have that formalism sort of laid out, sort of the rough picture of it, I can take advantage of that to get some intuition for how these sensors respond to different sorts of things like accelerations or other inertial forces. And as I already mentioned, so the simple picture is the atom interferometer. It acts sort of like we're measuring where the atom is with respect to this laser ruler at some number of points in time, depending on how many pulses that we use. And it turns out, and this is hard to convince you of, in the time that I have, it turns out that for this Mach-Zehnder geometry, the propagation and separation terms tend to cancel out in many situations, with some caveats. And it's really mostly this laser phase that you want to be thinking about for calculating the phase shift. So essentially where you are, k dot x, at each of the pulses. So what I want to show is, and I think this is a nice result, is that this interferometer, and this I think gets at sort of why these sensors can have a lot of variety of applications, is that it's a sort of a general way to measure what I'm calling a discrete derivative sensor. So it's a way to measure forces and potentials that vary at different length scales, either spatially or temporally, I should say, by using the number of pulses to sort of set the number of derivatives, the order of the derivative that I'm taking with this sensor. And so let me make that concrete with a couple examples. And this is where I'll tie back into how atomic clocks and atom interferometers are closely related. So we'll talk about an atomic clock as I think about it, which is as an example of an atom interferometer. So an atomic clock is an atom interferometer in this sense. So here's an atomic clock. It's a two-level system, ground excited state. I'm back to using blue for the ground state. Sorry for being all over the place on that. And here we're going to consider the example of a microwave atomic clock. So this is the current time standard based on like the cesium transition at 9.2 gigahertz. And the reason I'm going to take that to start with is that since the photon is a gigahertz photon, the recoil velocity is very small. And so even though I'm thinking about like an atom interferometer and I'm showing sort of an atom interferometer diagram, any recoil velocity is very, very small for this transition in question. And so I can essentially ignore that the recoil phase shifts and any sort of lack of overlap. These will always be within their coherence length, and I'll always have interference without having to worry about pi pulses. So a clock sequence, an example of a clock sequence is a pi over 2. This is called a Ramsey sequence. So no pi pulse here, just beam splitter, and then you wait some time, and then do another beam splitter. So we'll calculate the phase shift of this. So I've got it here, and then I'll talk about how to think about that or how I think about it. So as I said, we're ignoring recoil stuff, so there's no separation that has to be accounted for. So we just have propagation and laser phase. And so the propagation phase, recall, was the action integral, but it includes the internal energy difference, which in this case, energy difference is omega A between these two states. That's the clock energy spacing. And so I'm going to have some propagation phase equal to that energy difference times time. And that minus sign came from the details. It turned out it was Lagrangian minus energy. So that's where the minus sign is there. So this is the propagation phase. But then there's also going to be a laser phase, which is essentially just k dot x, where I am at pi over 2 pulse and at the second pi over 2 pulse. So this is phi 1 and phi 2. They're just this phase, phi l, measured at two different times. If we just resolve that, I guess I should remember it's not just k dot x. There's also this omega term, so that's omega of the laser. That's the laser's frequency. And so we're going to get an omega term showing up here, separated by the time at big T between the pulses. And then I also have x1 and x2 showing up, which is where the atom was at these two pulses. So before I go into this, which is kind of the point I wanted to be making, let's talk first about this first term. So this is why this thing is a clock. So the phase shift depends on the difference between the laser's frequency and the internal state or the internal energy of the atom. And so the way you can talk about a Ramsey sequence is essentially as a comparison between how much phase the atom accumulated while it was in the superposition for a time t, and how much time and how much phase the laser accumulated while you were waiting. And you're just measuring that phase difference, or you're encoding that phase difference in the phase shift of the interferometer or in the phase shift of the clock. And in a real clock, you would measure this phase shift. And if you noticed that there was a difference between omega and omega A, if there was a phase shift, non-zero phase shift, you would apply some feedback to the laser to serve it back onto resonance and keep the keep this phase shift zero. And that's how you build the laser so that it's always on resonance with the atomic transition. So that's sort of the clock part. But I'm interested actually in this x1 minus x2 part, which I can rewrite in terms of the atom's overall velocity. Like the atom, maybe the atom is not at rest, but it's moving through my experiment at some velocity v. So then I have the average velocity v equals x1 minus x2 over t, let's say. And so what that looks like is now a Doppler shift. So I could think about that as, if I wanted to associate that with this other parentheses here, I could put it inside, and it looks like k dot v, the Doppler shift of the atom with respect to the laser. So clocks are sensitive to the velocity of the atom. They're sensitive to Doppler shifts. Or in the language of an inertial sensor, it's measuring the velocity of the atom. It's encoding that velocity in the phase shift. And that's great if you want to measure the velocity of an atom in addition to time. So that's sort of the first example, a clock sequence. And now we'll compare that to an accelerometer sequence. So to make an accelerometer, so as I said, this measures velocity in the sense I just said. I can think of the Mach-Zehnder sequence that I've been showing, this pi over 2, pi over 2. It's basically two of these clock sequences, these Ramsey sequences glued end to end, right, where I have pi over 2, and then this pi pulse can be really thought of as two pi over 2 pulses right next to each other. And so you kind of see this sort of opening part of the clock, that's the first half of the atom interferometer, and then since we do this pi pulse, we basically end up having a second clock, but with the internal states reversed, so instead of red being up and green being low, we sort of swap them. And so the phase shift ends up just being the difference between two clock sequences. So that means all of this stuff here, omega A terms, will all cancel because I spend just as much time in the internal states on both halves of the accelerometer sequence. And the only thing that's going to wind up surviving are the laser phase at each of these interaction points. So you've got sort of the difference of two of these phi 1 minus phi 2s that I had from the clock. And so what's cool about that is that we've got kV1, so that's the velocity during the first half, and then during the second half of the interferometer, the velocity, maybe it's changed, maybe the velocity is now slightly different. So I've got V2 here coming from the second clock half, if you like, and so I can rewrite that V1 minus V2 as a mean acceleration A times t squared. So kAt squared is that is in fact the phase shift response to acceleration that the atom interferometer has. So you can see how it only is non-zero if the velocity of the atom is changing during the sequence. So that's why this measures acceleration. And we can I was calling this a discrete derivative sensor. So essentially I've measured with the clock sequence the derivative of the position by looking at it at two points in time. That tells me velocity. If I look at three points in time, I've taken a second derivative, and now I measure acceleration. And I can go on further and add sort of, I can do back-to-back Mach-Zehnder sequences in the so-called double diamond configuration, where I'm essentially subtracting two accelerometers, and then I get sort of whatever the differential acceleration between the two would be to the n times now t cubed. And so every pulse that I add is basically taking another derivative of the response. Let's see. So this can let you do some pretty fancy things. You can use it to cancel systematic errors, for example. So sometimes these sort of example I just gave of these gravity of sort of a acceleration variation, so a delta A, that can happen either in time or in space. If it happens in space, we would call it a gravity gradient. So the acceleration of gravity might vary during the first half of the interferometer versus the second half, and that can cause the accelerometer to have some perturbation on top of it proportional to the gravity gradient, here written as TZZ. And you can take advantage of the sort of flexibility that you have with the pulse timing to cancel that out if you want. So we just showed this double diamond before, the symmetric double diamond, which ends up measuring this acceleration gradient if you want to do that. But if you're not interested in measuring a gravity gradient or acceleration gradient, you can make an asymmetric double diamond. And it turns out if you choose the ratio between these times to be the golden ratio, then you can cancel off the response due to the acceleration gradient. You essentially weight these two diamonds in such a way that you still respond to the mean acceleration during the sequence, but you kind of can delete the response to the acceleration gradient, and that can be good for systematic error reasons. So we have all sorts of degrees of freedom like this that we can use to change the nature of the response. I don't know how am I doing on time. I think I'm winding up.
A couple more minutes.
Yeah. So I won't get to everything that I was going to today, but we'll catch up with it tomorrow. Maybe I'll just end by giving some numbers for sort of how the sensitivity, sort of what sets the fundamental sensitivity of these sensors, and then we'll use that to talk about sort of what sort of experiments we can do. So. Basically, we just walked through the acceleration response for these sensors. It looks like the laser k times the acceleration, in this case g, t squared. So I derived that for you in the previous slide. And so to make the sensitivity as large as possible, we want to sort of maximize that phase shift so we can see very small accelerations or the smallest possible acceleration. And so there's sort of two natural ways to do that. You can change the time t by waiting longer between pulses, but you can also actually increase the laser wave vector k effective here, and so k effective is the momentum transfer. It's proportional to how far we're splitting the two halves of the atom. So I gave you two examples already. There was a single photon atom optics where k effective would be 1k, and then there were Bragg transitions and Raman transitions where you use a two photon transition, and then k effective would be 2 times k of the laser. But we can actually extend that even further to, as we'll see, even hundreds of h bar k to increase that. And so we want to basically build interferometers with really long duration and a sort of a very large minimum transfer to increase this sort of scale factor of the interferometer. And then finally, sort of the fundamental readout for these is basically limited by atom counting statistics, by shot noise, right? So we're just looking at the ratio of two populations in these two ports, and that will have some fluctuations given by 1/1. So the phase has some uncertainty given by 1/1 the square root of the number of atoms. So you also want to, in principle, have as many atoms as possible. The way to get long duration that's been proven to work is to just have a really long drop time. So 10-meter scale atomic founds is kind of the state of the art. And so this is the 10-meter tower at Stanford. There's also a machine in Germany that's been recently built. There's a 10-meter tower in China. And recently there's been a group in the UK that's putting together a 10-meter fountain too. So these things are sprouting up all over the world. And these give you sort of 1-second scale drop times to maximize that time parameter. And so this is some early data from the rubidium fountain showing that. I think I'll skip over the details of this. Just showing that we can see interference after multiple seconds. So that's kind of the state of the art. But then the sort of second component of that was the wave packet separation or the momentum transfer, which leads to the wave packet separation. And I thought I would maybe I'll wrap up on the next slides, but we'll talk through the wave packet separation idea here. So how do you increase the momentum transfer beyond sort of 1 or 2 h bar k? Essentially, one way to do it is just to use multiple sequential pulses. So after splitting the atom with a conventional pi over 2 pulse, it's possible to add a train of pulses, each of them transferring additional momentum. So you can see this pulse train here. And so the cartoon of that is shown here in the space-time diagram. After the atom is split, you can see sort of zoomed in here. You've got, this work was done with Bragg transitions, so the atom was in a superposition of the ground state, a 0 h bar k initial state and 2 h bar k. And you can apply another Bragg transition, which will promote the 2 h bar k to the 4 h bar k while leaving the 0 h bar k alone. And so now you have superposition of 0 and 4. And then you can repeat that along this train, and each pulse transfers an additional 2 h bar k in this case. Ultimately, we got up to 90 h bar k relative momentum between the two arms in this experiment. And that's what led to this sort of wave packet separation that I showed you in the first couple slides. So you can see the sort of the spike here and the other spike, And that's this sort of rubidium ensemble that's separated by about half a meter. But as was pointed out, that's not an interference experiment. That's just an observation of the fact that you split this population by a large amount. So to see interference, we bring the two halves back together and make sure we can still see constructive and destructive interference. And so I think I'll wrap up with some physics because I think it's kind of fun. So this is an example of what that's good for. The background here is, you know, if you can start to split the two halves of the atom by a large enough amount, you can start to see non-trivial tidal forces across the wave function of the atom. And so this is kind of a cartoon of that. You see sort of maybe a curved metric, for example, and you got the two halves of the atom separated by a large amount. And it turned out up until recently, the only gravitational effect that had been seen was due to the acceleration of gravity, sort of the uniform acceleration of gravity. In order to see a tidal force or gravity gradient, the arms of the interferometer have to be separated by a large enough amount compared to that gradient. And so in this work, what we did was sort of used two atom interferometers, one essentially as a reference and the other as a test of the gravity gradient. And so you can see maybe the cartoon here is better. So you can see this is sort of a snapshot of what the interferometers looked like sort of at the midpoint here, at the maximum separation. So this is the upper and lower arm of one interferometer, and this is the upper and lower arm of the other interferometer. And you can see sort of one of these interferometers is pretty close to a big chunk of lead. And the other one is, let's say, far enough away that it doesn't see the lead. And so this lead brick produces a gravity gradient. And by sort of varying whether the lead was near or far, we could see the influence of that gravity gradient and how it perturbed this interferometer with respect to this control. And you can see that in the data here. So this, you can see this, the fringes here, they're sort of all they're sort of lined up in this case, and they're misaligned there. So the phase difference between those two interferometers, between the upper and lower interferometer, is the result of the sort of influence of the gravity gradient of the lead. So it's sort of a radian level shift that you could see in this particular experiment. And so that's kind of cool because you're really seeing the effect of tidal forces across a quantum state. And if we believe GR, we know that, you know, gravity is really all about tidal forces and not uniform accelerations. And so you might be tempted to say that this is getting at something more interesting about gravity than a uniform acceleration measurement, which from the equivalence principle, we can sort of just always transform away by choosing a freely falling frame. You can't do that in this case. It's a sort of a phase shift across the wave function itself. So I ought to stop. I have more to say, of course, but we'll pick up tomorrow. But yeah.
Questions? Maybe three. Then we have a break. We have another one.
Do you actually care about your species that you use here? Other than like technological benefits, is there anything you'd rather have other than strontium or rubidium or something like that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it'd be fair to say that it's often motivated by the sort of technical things, but yeah, there are definitely experiments that you can think of doing where you would care. Like for example, if you're looking for the kind of fifth force measurements that we heard Peter talking about, you know, it's a sort of a model dependent question, but you can ask, you know, what is the you can at least think about asking what's the best two choices if you're going to compare. Let's say you're going to compare two kinds of atoms with different nuclear structure or different species. What's the most different thing you can do? And this is the same sort of thing people do with equivalence principle tests. So I think that's a fair question, and often while that can be compelling, we're still going to be tempted to do something that we can actually implement. Yeah. And so in particular, with a sort of a dual species atom interferometer where you're trying to run, you know, two different species at the same time, you have to think about how will the laser interact with those two species in a common way, because, you know, we often are worrying about the noise of the laser and how to subtract that off. And so they're using, in the case of equivalence principle measurements, you know, we've used like two different isotopes of the same atom where you can use the same laser to address them. But in principle, that's not a constraint. You could, it's just more difficult to do other kinds.
Okay, thank you.
Jason, thanks for this great talk. Question for the previous slide, a very practical one actually. So
this one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you say in that case you had 90 photons worth of momentum. What prevents you to do another 2, 3, 4 orders of magnitude more photons.
That's something I think about every day. Yeah, that's definitely the focus of my group's efforts right now. But in this case, the limitation was spontaneous emission. So these are 2-photon Bragg transitions that were being used here. And so what sets spontaneous emission rate is how far you can detune the laser from the excited state that's causing the loss. And so you want to detune that as much as you can. But as you do that, the coupling of the 2-photon transition goes down. So to compensate that, you crank up the laser power. And so if you had a higher laser power, you could detune even further. But that tends to be hard to do. So it was limited, you could say, by laser power and therefore by spontaneous emission in this particular case. And with alkali atoms like rubidium, which is what this work was done, this is around 100 h-bar-k, I think that there's an argument one can make that I think is convincing, that it's possible to go to like 1,000 probably, 1,000 h-bar-k, before this idea of detuning further kind of stops working. Because at some point, that state you're detuning from, it isn't the only state in the rubidium atom. There are other states around that can start to mess up that spontaneous emission suppression. I think with the next generation laser upgrades that folks that are using rubidium are doing, that one could go as high as possibly 1,000 with alkali. With the alkaline earth like strontium, which is something that my group is exploring, we think there's a lot more headroom for the spontaneous emission question. It turns out the level structure is more favorable, and at least from that perspective, if that were the only loss, you could imagine doing like 10^5 or more pulses. So I am an optimist about this, thinking like that certainly 10^3 to 10^4 may be possible. Recently, my group demonstrated over 400 h-bar-k using strontium, which is a record for sequential pulse. So that does seem to be the leading way to get momentum transfer with sequential pulses, use the alkaline earth. But we would like to, in the short term, hit 1,000 h-bar-k milestone. That's our next big step. And I think you can go to 1,000 probably, or maybe 10,000. So yeah, this is always, like, the spontaneous emission limit is the fundamental thing, but then there's all sorts of technical things that you have to worry about, inhomogeneities and things like that. It's very similar in spirit to the kinds of hunt for better fidelity that people in quantum information are working on. And we use very similar techniques. You know, you can use composite pulse techniques and various adiabatic passage type ideas. So in fact, there's a lot we can learn from that community in that, and we steal from those ideas and try to apply them. But yeah, try to get high fidelity, single qubit gates, you would call them, but otherwise it's very similar in spirit, so.
I'm just curious, you mentioned the strontium first excited state has extremely long lifetime. What's so special about the state that gives him this property?
Yeah, you can see the level diagram here. Maybe I can just say it, but it's a single to triplet transition, and so it's protected by selection rules, basically. Here's the diagram. No, it's not. That's not the right one. This is the right one. Yeah. So triplet to singlet doesn't tend to go. The reason that it goes is there's some higher order mixing between these levels that lets you. This guy here, the triple P1, gets a little bit of that mixture of 1P0, gives sort of a kilohertz wide transition, and then that transition mixes with triple P0 via the nuclear spin of the fermion. It causes sort of a magnetic induced coupling between those two. And so that gives you the sort of millihertz line width. And it only is true for the fermionic isotope because it has the non-zero nuclear spin. All the bosons of strontium have like I equals zero, and so they have no hyperfine structure and no mixing between those two levels. So this transition only goes for that fermion, and it's very weak because it's sort of suppressed in those two ways. So it's something called doubly forbidden there are a number of levels like this. Strontium is not unique, but strontium has other useful properties in terms of the laser cooling and things like that that make it sort of a great candidate for this. So, yep. Yeah.
I just ask mechanically, so you launch these, you first trap them all in one of these optical traps, and then you let go of the trap, so they're in free fall, and that's right. When you start the pi over 2 pulse?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, so we want them in free fall so that we are measuring the... the free fall motion. Let's see, I'll say something about that.
And we
don't want to hold on to them because then otherwise we're going to be impacting, we're going to be measuring essentially the restoring force. But an optical lattice clock is sort of, that's a bit, one big difference between a clock and an atom interferometer is that in lattice clocks you do grab onto the atoms and you hold them tightly in this sort of lattice, this standing wave trap. So, but in an atom interferometer, it's falling freely in vacuum, so that we can really look at the sort of inertial response of the atom, how it's falling with respect to the reference frame.
Right. I'm asking an even simpler question. So, do they start at the top? Do they start at the bottom?
We can do it either way.
What is the physical geometric structure in your lab at Stanford? What is it doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So we can do it either way. I think. Let me know if I'm answering your question. Basically, if we want to start at the bottom, we want to do some sort of a fountain. So we tend to launch the atoms from if we start from the bottom, we want them to come up and down. And the launch is sort of an interesting thing. I could give a whole lecture on that. It's kind of fun. But you can do it a number of ways. You can use laser cooling tricks to imbalance the cooling forces and launch them. That's how fountain clocks work. Like that's how the rubidium fountain clocks work in the current time standard. We tend to not want to do that because it can heat them in the process of launching. So we actually will use an optical lattice to launch them. So very similar technology to the lattice clocks. But instead, we would sort of do a vertical standing wave, like a one-dimensional standing wave along the direction of the launch. And then once you trap the atoms in that standing wave, let's say it's at rest in the lab frame, so counterpropagating laser beams, if you chirp the laser, if you change the frequency of the laser, then what you end up doing is change the velocity of that standing wave. So we can controllably accelerate that standing wave from rest to whatever target final velocity we want. And that's a coherent acceleration, so it doesn't heat them. In other words, it's no scattered light, and so we call that an optical lattice launch. And so in the 10 meter fountain experiment that I showed you, and this tidal force measurement and all the Large Momentum Transfer stuff, pretty much all the data I showed you today in these 10 meter fountains, you end up needing a couple thousand h bar k, like 2,040 h bar k of momentum transfer. To get up to the sort of 10 meter per second level, and that optical lattice is a very efficient way to do that. So much so that some other groups will use optical lattice accelerations as an atom optic to implement Large Momentum Transfer beam splitters, like to split the atom by hundreds of h bar k. And so when I mentioned earlier that my group had set a new record, I was careful to say by sequential pulse methods, because if you use optical lattice methods, you can split them by using this lattice technique. And there are pros and cons of that from an atom interferometer point of view, actually. So we don't want to do that typically, although there's a case to be made for it. But so we use the lattice as a launch, but not we don't use it during the sequence itself to implement the measurement. So I'm taking your question as an excuse to just talk about optical lattices.
That's exactly what I want. Thank you.
Yes, in fact, we use optical lattice to translate the atoms horizontally and also launch them. So we can use them all over the place to manipulate where the atoms are. Is there one question? One more?
I'm sure you have talked about this somewhere, but I'm wondering, for laser interferometry, we're pretty much limited by laser shot noise, and for atom interferometry, I'm wondering if there is such fundamental limit on sensitivity.
Well, as I mentioned, that is the kind of baseline fundamental limitation you have if you don't do anything fancy. You would have sort of counting statistics, so that'd be atom shot noise rather than sort of photon shot noise. But in either case, you can play games with entanglement to try to do better than that, right? And so in atom interferometry, by using a correlated atom ensemble, you can hope to improve beyond the sort of 1 over square root of n scaling. So that's something that my group doesn't do a lot, but we're very interested in importing those ideas in some of the future gravitational wave detectors, for example. So I might mention that in passing tomorrow, but I won't say much about the details of that. But using quantum entanglement as a resource for improved metrology is a hot topic in the field for how to and there's been demonstrations of factors of 10 improvement in sort of the performance of, like, let's say a clock. But how to translate that into a freely falling atom interferometer is work that's just now starting to happen. And so the exciting thing for me is to see how that preliminary work eventually translates into the kinds of second-long interferometers that we need to do, and how to do the readout of that using squeeze sources is still an active topic of research. But I think ultimately that's the ultimate limit of these sensors, is if you could use a squeeze source.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's thank Jason again.